It's the motherfucking millennial Miha podcast.
Okay, so in setting up the podcast, the anxiety of it came out.
So I'm so funny. Well, you're also funny because you're actually the one that made the joke.
Oh yeah,
if we like, were. So I don't know who said it, but I want to take credit. So it was me.
Well, we were talking about how anxiety
permeates.
It's a constant state, and no one really acknowledges.
Yeah, what people don't realize about anxiety is that it's a constant state of being. Like I was like, I feel like a chihuahua.
Yeah.
And she was like, well, it's not because we're Mexican. And I'm like, no, if I was in a dog movie for Disney, hint, hint, I would be a chihuahua. Not because I'm Mexican, but because I have anxiety.
Like, I've done dog personality tests, like, on BuzzFeed.
Wait, what?
And, like, what kind of dog are you? Maybe we could do one live. That'll be fun.
No! What? Okay, go ahead.
I'll pull it up.
So, welcome back to the Millennial Miha podcast. We are back in the bedroom because I was too nervous on the other one. Like, I was too... When we recorded at the Pasadena Media in the studio, first of all, let me tell y'all what was going on. There was construction the entire time.
Well, leading up to the interview.
And then I'm just stressing out because I'm just like, I have two people here. Like, to have two guests for a podcast, you're like...
So we really appreciate Brenda and Sheehan for bearing with us.
Why do you call him Sheehan?
Sheehan? Did I say it weird?
Sheehan, fool.
Sheehan. Damn it. See, this is how whitewashed I am.
I don't know if that's whitewashed. I think that's just bad pronunciation.
Maybe, because I don't talk to a lot of people. Honestly, I don't talk
to a lot. This girl reminds me of Daria.
I love Daria.
Like, yeah, we need to have a Daria segment, and then that'll be me talking to you.
Six Sad World.
yes. We'll that'll be your segment. And then it's like...
Tonight on Six Sad World.
And hi. With Felicia.
You're standing on my neck.
Hi.
So what we're about to do right now...
is what dog are we?
Oh, shit. Okay, we have to get this done first.
Friday night plans. What are your plans? Party time? Quick drink before you snuggle with a book? No one invited you anywhere. Another OkCupid date, binging on Netflix, clubbing, dinner with your fab friends, snoozing, props a hot photo shoot.
Ooh, props a hot photo shoot. Okay, well, the photo shoot's gonna happen no matter what, no matter which scenario that I end up in, but I would definitely say it's like a combination of a quick drink of wine before I snuggle in, but not with a book, but with a Netflix series.
Let's do binging on Netflix.
All right, cool.
That's like the main action.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe not Netflix. What's your body type? Oh. This is so rude. Why does it matter?
Because they have to know what dog we are, dummy.
I guess. They could still guess.
Okay, definitely not naturally thin.
Small, athletic.
I would say more to love.
What's Pauly D?
Pauly D. Oh, like
buff?
Really buff? Okay. But like, why did somebody put that? Muscular. Why does it matter? You?
Yeah, that's what I would put when I take.
Short and curvy. I would say more to love.
More to love. Okay, pick a color. I'm going to guess lime.
Lime green. How'd you know?
Brandy. Wow. What would the name of your memoir be? Just Friends, a Love Story. Eat, Love, and Eat More. Are you sure it's not that ass?
Okay.
Or How I Learned to Love My Mess, Life and Times of a Misunderstood Hero, Growing Without Roots. Why is that one so deep? That's really intense.
Whoa. I think it's because you're high.
Yeah.
Also same.
Yeah. Running in Circles, An Exploration in the Futility of Life. I found mine. Don't Mind If I Do, A Guide to Getting What You Want. I Wish. Who? Me?
I think I definitely have to pick How I Learned to Love My Mess.
All right.
That's a real, that's a poem.
Yeah.
Thanks, BuzzFeed.
What's your go-to dance move?
The wiggle, booty dropping, judging in the corner. Judging in the corner. Ballroom dancing, the hippie. The shopping cart. Oh, I think that's the...
When you do this,
Shit, I know exactly what move that is. Yeah. I wish y'all could see me. Aggressive voguing. Oh.
Yes.
Aggressive voguing? grinding, all about the fist pump. Is that NSYNC? Oh, that must be clickbait.
Which decade do you actually belong in?
Wait, let's finish this quiz before we go through another.
So what's your dance move? I think mine's
blue. Mine is a combination of aggressively voguing and judging in the corner.
Aggressively judging and voguing in the corner. So if you had to pick one, which one? Which is your voguing? There you go.
Vogue. Come on. Vogue. How do you cure a hangover?
A Bloody Mary, French fries, a bagel sandwich, a bath, sleeping, I guess. Greasy food like pizza, coffee and Advil, working out, or I don't get hangovers.
Definitely none of these. So tortilla soup something to like replenish the things that I've lost from my body. I'd say pizza.
Pizza.
I love pizza. Oh my God. Mushroom and bacon with extra sauce. You've never had that?
No. Nope.
You're not like me. No, you're not. All right. I made that up.
It sounds really good. So I'm down to try it. What kind of exercise do you prefer?
Yoga, throwing around a ball, sprints, whatever the hottest new trend is. Oh God. Ha 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 ha. Getting excited, then running in circles. Sex. Hello. Opening the door for delivery. I'm a gym rat. Definitely sex. Kidding me? Sex and hiking.
Like, they didn't even give hiking as an option.
That's because they are just so, you know, elitist.
Whatever.
You don't have to have a membership for that, bitch. Do ya? No. Nature.
Yes.
Pick an author. Nicholas Sparks, definitely not. Toni Morrison, hey girl. David Sedaris, don't know who that is. Junot Diaz, yes, like him. J.K. Rowling, oh my God.
So many
opinions. Amiri Baraka, fuck yeah. Who made this? They know good ones. Sylvia Plath, oh God, she tried to possess me. The internet or I don't read. Oh, Albert I don't read. Camus. Albert Camus.
I read one book of his in high school. And
I don't, which book? I know it's like a classic, right?
It's called The Stranger, and it's...
That sounds scary.
Not even 100 pages. It involves a murder. And like, completely...
This is why you are how you are.
A lot of high school factors why I am the way I am.
Out of all of these, definitely go with Toni Morrison. All
right.
Definitely the most revolutionary of all of these people. Mm-hmm. Which pop star do you identify with the most?
Beyonce.
Cher? T-Swift? No. Robin from the 90s?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Ira Glass. Britney? Yes. But she's been disappointing me lately. I refuse to dignify that question. Lord, X. Oh, God. Christina with an X? Definitely.
She's coming back now.
Who do I identify with the most? Probably Ira Glass.
Yes. All right, what is your number one pet peeve? Taking food off my plate, chatterboxes, I don't think so, pretentious people, probably, pimple poppers, the patriarchy,
ew,
being a meanie.
What's the question?
What's your number one pet peeve?
Oh.
Chipped nail polish, judgmental people.
Oh my God.
Or having pet peeves.
All of these.
This entire question is triggering.
Taking food off my plate, you better not. Chatterboxes, I am one. Pretentious people, ugh. Pimple poppers, I refuse to even watch that shit. That sounds nasty. The patriarchy, definitely. Being a meanie, yes. I don't like mean people because what the fuck is the point? Like, what do you get out of that? That's really trash.
Like, there's roasting your friends and then there's just being mean.
Yeah. Chipped nail polish, yeah. Definitely don't let that happen. Judgmental people, I hate them. Oh God. Like you ain't never made a mistake before in your life?
Right.
Damn. Having pet peeves? What?
Like your number one pet peeve is having a pet peeve, maybe, or
yeah, I hate that I haven't even have to have them. So okay, right. I'll take that one.
Alright. They're a problem to deal with.
Well, are we really doing a quiz live on air for no reason at all?
We can cut it out or we can keep it. That's the great part.
Yes.
There's so many options.
How would your friends describe you? Artistic? Larger than life? A girl? Maybe. Intro, introverted, superhero, needy, yeah, comforting, yes, funny, hilarious, loyal, definitely, high maintenance, for sure.
Oh, God, where's the above all, except for introverted?
Definitely not superhero and not introverted. Actually, I am personally introverted, like, when I get really, like, oh, my God, when there's a lot of people that I might have to talk to. Like, even walking into a yard sale the other day, I started getting an anxious, like, an anxiety attack, and I just had to get back in the car. I was like, no, there's too many people in a close proximity to me, and they might talk to me, and then I might die.
It's too much. I can't handle it.
No. I think this is a trick question because I don't have any friends.
Ah, adulthood.
So they would probably say I am... They high maintenance.
Okay.
That is definitely what they would call me. Oh my God.
A corgi.
Oh my God, I'm so happy.
Quite simply, you're a darling. People are mesmerized by your charismatic nature, but you never get too caught up in all that praise. You know how to just be you and let be you at all times without apology. Plus, you have a cute little tush.
Oh, well,
that's adorable.
That's true. I guess I'm a corgi, so there it is, motherfuckers.
You're a corgi.
So what we're about to do is we're about to listen to the following episode. It's basically a live on-air anxiety attack because I can't keep my focus of what I want to say. And usually, like, at the end of every, at the end of every conversation, I feel really good about it.
Yeah.
I feel like there was just, like, this connection was made. And in this scenario, I was just so thrown by my environment that I felt like I wasn't able to... I don't know, create a great conversation because I was like, I wasn't staying on topic. I kept blocking the conversation from like getting better.
You were trying to like go through the structured outline.
I was too structured.
Yeah. You were in a seat in, you're being filmed because we were trying the visual aspect.
Yeah.
There were outside factors inside that were affecting the little room we were in. So
yeah. Cause of the construction. And I was like, definitely hyper aware of my body and myself. Just that's lately how I've been feeling. And
you did said you were excited and anxious for the interview overall because you were excited to talk to Brendan Sheehan. So you were already nervous, and then all the environmental factors came in and like just piled on.
Definitely. See, Daria, you get me. So what we're going to do is we're going to listen to this episode, and I'm going to interject
your feelings.
Yes, the things that I forgot to say because I was too worried about the like crane across the street that was like beep beep beep, and I'm like, what the heck is going on here?
There was a point where we were set up, we were ready to go, and had to wait for the garbage truck to pass.
Yeah,
because you could clearly hear it.
Yeah.
So that was a little bit weird. That causes.
And then also I learned the lesson of if you're going to do a podcast and you have two guests, like don't make them get there the same time you get there because you don't have time to like acclimate to the space. Like you need time to, well, at least I do. I can only speak for myself, but I mean, I felt like I should have gotten there and just like acclimated to the space, even saged it. Fuck that. Like maybe. Even saged it, just whoo, saw it in there for a little bit and then got started.
Yeah.
And then, but I learned a lesson, and next time I'll have them get there, like, you know, because it's a 4-hour slot of time that we have to record in the studio.
Yeah.
So they could just get there an hour later than me. That's better. So that's what we'll learn from now on. That's why I like that we're doing this right now, because I don't want to have anxiety about what I put into the world.
Yeah.
Like, and so I have to just let it be what it was, because I'm not going to throw that away, because I still believe that those interviews were valuable and that I want to, you know, put them out there. But I just want to be 100% honest and keep it 100% real about how I'm feeling in any moment. And that's what I want this podcast to be, is like that. That's part of your healing, is like to be real with yourself and to be real with the world. And so, yeah, let's get into it. Welcome back to the Millennial Miha podcast. I'm Millennial Miha, and I am here today with my friend, Sheehan Van Cleef. He is a part-time poet and a part-time tightrope walker.
And also does a little bit of dog walking on the side. And then I have a new friend, scholar and artivist Brenda Perez.
Hi.
Welcome, both of you. I'm so excited for you to be here.
Thanks for having me.
So we are here today at the first ever recording in a studio for Millennial Mija Podcast, and we're here live from Pasadena Media. I feel like since I started this whole podcast from my room, and you know, recording on my phone, it feels cool to finally be in like a professional studio situation. So I'm glad that you two are my first guests.
Thank you. Thank honored you.
So what I want to start off with is segment called What's the Sitch. So what's the sitch? And what's the sitch is just an update about what has happened since the last time you heard my voice on the podcast. And so what has happened is that Los Angeles is in mourning. We all know that on January 26th, Kobe Bryant and his daughter were on their way to basketball camp. They were tragically killed in a helicopter accident. So I don't know if that has impacted either of you. Let's start with you, Shihan. What were your thoughts on that?
I mean, I was just kind of surprised by it. But being a father, I think the first thing I thought about, which, you know, I have a daughter and two sons, and I thought about what you do in that moment to comfort your kid when you know that's it.
Yeah.
And so I was just thinking about what that moment must have been like, which is terrible to think about that moment, but yeah, that's really what I thought about. Mm-hmm. Like, what the hell do you do other than hug, say I love you,
yeah,
but knowing
that
in whatever
protect
many times it's yeah done. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of it, really. I just thought, you know, he has a bigger impact for people who grew up and
watching,
you know,
basketball,
grow up, especially like LA or Lakers, you know, being from New York, I'm still a Knicks fan, even though we're terrible. So when mm-hmm he died, I'm like, it has a bigger impact on people who he was part of the stitching of the city,
yeah,
more than in my life where I was like, dang, he was a dope ass player, father, but that's ill. Cause I just thought about father being a father.
Yeah.
That was the first thing I thought about.
Yeah. How you can connect to him. And I think, for me, it was like, I had never, ever seen my, my boyfriend have such an emotional reaction to anything. Like, that was actually like, I was taken aback by how emotional he was and how openly he cried. And because he's the type of person that just doesn't do that often, it was just like seeing him get so emotional, like, really impacted me. But then I also kind of thought about my own memories that I have of Kobe Bryant, which is not really of basketball, but what I do remember is being in a bar when I was like in my 20s. And that's when he did that like 81-point game. And everybody went wild in the bar. And they were like, hey, Kobe Bryant just scored however many points. And I was like, is that a lot? Like, I had no idea. I remember seeing how his work ethic and how his game was just like so much more superior. And they were telling me he was better than Michael Jordan. And that was like my Kobe story. With all these people reading their stories online has been like so emotional. He impacted a lot of people's lives. And I remember it feeling... the feeling of how it felt in LA was the same way it felt when Nipsey died. Mm-hmm. It was it was just like the whole city was heavy.
Yeah, he's part of the fabric of LA's culture. Like, Kobe is loved, deeply loved by LA, and we embraced him. And for me, when I heard about it, it was a shocker. You know what I'm saying? It was incredibly difficult to accept. And it was even harder to know that his daughter was with him, you know, so young. And it's sad. We lost an amazing human being, and his daughter was right there with them and the other families as well.
Yeah. It was just like too, sometimes things are just too much. Like, you don't even know, because I lost my dad in 2011, and that floored me. Like, that derailed my entire life. And so for me, I was just more thinking about Vanessa, like, how yes in the world could you even process without just like dying, like, immediately, like, the pain and the grief that I experienced just by losing my dad, and then you amplify that like 1,000,000,000 kajillion times by losing your husband and your daughter on the same day. Like, how do you even process, or how do you begin to
move on?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah.
And so I just, my heart goes out to that family. And then, you know, the other people that were in the helicopter, a family of five, and the mom, the dad, and one of the daughters. So there's two daughters that are left. Their entire family got taken.
Wow.
Wow.
It's heavy.
Yeah.
It's very
yeah
heavy.
And so I just want to send my like energy and like healing love. And there's nothing that's going to solve this for her, for that family. There's nothing. There's no amount of words in the world that can sum up how they must be feeling. But I just wanted to acknowledge that. Another thing that's new is I actually released my audiobook of the book that I published in 2016. Where Shihan was at my book release party, and he performed at my book release. Do you remember that day?
Mm-hmm.
And so I, you know, I think back then when I first published my book, I didn't give it enough love and I didn't promote it at all because I was in a place where I just wasn't really ready to take myself serious as an artist. And so I didn't take myself serious as an artist. And it wasn't until now that I'm starting to really come into myself that I'm like, you know what? I want to give that book a new life. And so I recorded it all the way through the audiobook, and it really did give it a new life. Because, you know, there's something different about the written word than there is about the spoken word. And yes. Especially I put myself back in my shoes of who I was when I wrote them. And that was an emotional process to like read the whole book all the way through. So whoever's listening, whoever has not listened to the audiobook, I did release it as an episode on the podcast and not on Audible, which is a subscription-based thing, because I wanted to make it free, like completely free and accessible to anybody who wants it, because I feel like there's a lot of wisdom in that book just for someone who is like so young, because I just went through everything. I don't think there's one happy poem in that book because it was where I put all of my feelings. So yeah, so if you can get some time and listen to that book if you have some time, because I think it's worth it. So what I want to change gears to is the reason why I asked Brenda Perez to come here. I reached out to her when I saw this post on Instagram, and it was a picture of the, I call it my mural. Like, I literally refer to it as my mural because growing up, it was a, it's right across from La Estrella, which is this taco place in Highland Park, where I grew up going there with my dad all the time. And that mural, it's called Tenochtitlan.
The Wall That Talks.
The Wall That Talks. Yeah. And It's basically a history, a visual history of Chicano activism, but also just like our culture all the way from the Aztec. There's a woman and she has her baby. It's just like the most beautiful thing. It's a continuous just journey all the way until like you see a computer at the end. It's like, you know, activism going online, and it's just the Chicano legacy. And so when I heard that it was going to be destroyed because the building had been bought by a developer, I felt helpless. I think it is kind of sad that it took me until this to really start to try and dive into this problem and try to become a part of it. But, you know, we are what we are, and that's what did it for me. And so that's why I invited you here, because you were the one who posted it, and yes. You were also organizing an action. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, my name is Brenda Perez, and I actually founded Restorative Justice for the Arts. And Restorative Justice for the Arts is a grassroots community project, and I take a lot of pride in it, because the reason I actually founded this community organization is because they erased John Zender Estrada's, one of the most iconic muralists in Los Angeles, but who also started the graffiti art movement after New York here in Los Angeles. So Zender's art, we all grew up with it. I'm sure you've seen it everywhere and don't know that it's him.
Yeah.
But, you know, his artwork is like imprinted in our brains, and they become images that are like our family. So when they erased his Aztec mural that was there since 1993, I felt like you. Like, I felt like someone stabbed me in the heart.
Yeah, and it took my breath away.
I couldn't stop crying. And I said, you know what? We need to get to the bottom of this. So I made a community meeting, and we said, we're going to get to the bottom of what happened. And so in getting in the bottom of that, we dug deeply into gentrification, which, you know, in Highland Park, gentrification is ground zero. Mm-hmm. So the beautiful thing about Restorative Justice for the Arts is that it's a grassroots community boots on the ground force that demands to know what and why our murals are getting whitewashed. Mm-hmm. Recently, we actually got smart and requested California Public Record Act's records, and we found out who erased them. So it's very important for our community to see that murals are all threatened. All of our murals are threatened. Just because a Department of Cultural Affairs in our city council says that they'll protect it, that's not true. The only thing that will save our murals is community and coming forward. You know what I'm saying? So that is what Restorative Justice for the Arts is focused. I'm also a PhD candidate, and I'm including this as part of my dissertation as to empower.
Chingona alert. Chingona alert. Chingona alert.
Yeah, so, you know, it's really difficult. This movement is purely female
led. And, you know, we get a lot of resistance from people who are in it for the glory, people who are in it for the money. And so I'm very proud to say that I'm not aligned with politicians. All I'm trying to do is I'm trying to put truth forward and show my community that our murals are not safe.
Yeah. And that's what I feel like that you've done. Because, I mean, when it reached me, it was like I emailed you. I, like, sent you a message because I felt like this was the last straw for me personally. Like,
right.
I think that it gentrification, sadly, it has to become deeply personal for someone to really get on board.
Right.
And that was deeply personal. That was because I remember specifically the day I learned about who Cesar Chavez was. And it was from that mural.
Yes.
And it was my dad telling me, like, you know, and he would take pictures. He would put me in front of the mural and he would take pictures of me in front of it. And he, okay. And he would.
I know, you're gonna make me cry.
He would say, like, this is your history. This is who you are. I wasn't expecting that. And, you know, it was just, it was deeply personal. And it came like a really big shock. Like, it just hit me like a wave of emotion. And I was trying to explain to my mom why it was so personal to me. And it was like the first time she ever believed me when it came to that, because my mom is white, my mom's Italian, and my dad was Mexican. And so there was this like deep divide. My dad would take me to a protest or talk to me about activism, and my mom would ask me, like, why are you so angry? And it's because she couldn't understand. No. She just can't understand. Mm-hmm. And so it was the first time where she sat with me, like, because I had been talking about gentrification since I was living there. I lived there for 10 years. And it was the first time she had heard the word, like, you know, when I started talking about it. But this was the first time where she was just like, this is wrong. Yes. Like, this is so wrong.
Yeah.
And she said it. She said, they're taking away your memories.
Yes.
And I was like, that's what it means, Mom.
Yes.
You got it.
And that's exactly why murals for our communities are so important. You're the fifth person that tells me you learned about Cesar Chavez with that mural. And that's the reason I was so affected by the way they erased and whitewashed the Cesar Chavez funded mural by Daniel Cervantes that portrayed the migrant farm workers and their love for the land during National Hispanic Heritage Month.
Yeah.
They whitewashed this mural during National Hispanic Heritage Month. So you can see the disrespect, the disregard, not just of our community, but of our culture. These murals contain the sacred imagery that brings up those memories and that keeps this legacy, these ancestral roots alive. Mm-hmm. And the erasure of these roots is a sacrilegious act. And that's what my research is all about, is explaining the sacredness of these memories and this medicine and how it continues to teach our youth, mm-hmm. no matter what. These memories that are triggered are those of the Nahuatl philosophy, la filosofía Nahuatl. In the filosofía Nahuatl that I study, all of the children had the tlamantine, who were the sabios, who were the teachers of this sacred knowledge. And this consciousness was fostered and bred through flor y canto. Right? So in Flor y Canto, the gift of the arts, that is important because it builds a higher consciousness, a consciousness that's healthy, and it takes you there. It takes you to a different level. Mm-hmm. And here in the Americas, we are disregarded as not good enough. Your art is trash. Your murals are eye pollution. And this is wrong. And this is colonialism, mm-hmm. right?
It's urban gentrification is right. urban colonialism. And that's truly, truly what it, the only way to describe it, because it's right. it's coming in and erasing people that are already there and then trying to act like you discovered it. Like,
right.
like they, yes. they, I heard someone say the up and coming neighborhood of Highland Park. I was up and coming. Yes. That's like, where did you, just cause you just barely got here. Yeah. Like, that's just too wild for me to, like, even get into. But it truly is. It's urban, you know, colonialism. And I think that what was so emotional for me was the fact that since my dad died, I could still go to La Estrella, get the same thing we ordered, look yes. at the same mural, and at least feel a little bit closer to home.
Yes.
But with that gone, where can I go?
Right.
There's no place I can go to visit the memory of my father other than the streets where he grew up.
Right.
Okay, so we moving on. Speaking of gentrification, have you all heard of the new show on Netflix called
Gentefied?
Yes. So I'm a little worried about that one.
Yeah, we don't know if it could go left or right. Have you heard of it?
Yes.
What have you seen?
I haven't seen anything yet. I saw the commercial, the trailer for it.
Based on the trailer, what is your initial thought?
I don't know, because there's, I like TV and I like shit. So looking at it, you could have a cool ass trailer and be trash. So yeah. I need to see what
the you need is. To see more.
Yeah.
When I saw it, I was just so excited because I know a girl that's in it. I know her name's Annie Gonzalez, and she has been an actress for a very long time, ever since I knew her. And so to see her get that role was really cool, and just to see her blossoming and doing that stuff. So I like the fact that it's trying to tackle an issue, but it's going to be the way they tackle it that we have to see how that pans out.
Yeah, it's also important to know, who did they talk to?
Yeah.
Did they talk to people who are just actors and know a little bit of gentrification? Or did they talk to people struggling and suffering through this systemic violence?
That's real. So I've been doing this thing called Chingona of the Day.
Let's go, girls.
Come on. And so that's just when I acknowledge somebody who I have seen either on Instagram or social media or just in the world, just out there doing the damn thing. And so there is a woman named Julissa Prado, and her company, Rizos Curls, she invented this curl program to restore women's curls because it was deeply personal to her. But what's so beautiful about that is that she employs her entire family. They do the whole thing out of her her Tio Juan's garage.
Wow.
And her...
That's a dope.
And her her product is now in Target.
Ooh.
And so this video that I'm about to show a couple seconds of it, when one of her followers, sent her a picture of the fact that her product has been sold out at Target. And so this is her reaction.
Okay, so I'm sitting here crying because the first customer just tagged us with a photo of Rizos Curls on shelf at Target. I didn't know I was going to get this emotional. Obviously, I've known that we're going to be at Target, but I haven't even seen it myself on the shelf. But somebody just tagged us, and I saw the picture of it there, and it made me really emotional because, that's my cousin's drawing on the bottle. That's the label, my brother and I found. Every single one of my family members, they helped me so much. Brother, my cousins, my Tio Juan's garage, where we started off. Literally, my aunt would prep all the stuff. We all, everybody played a role in it, bro. My crazy, crazy idea from years ago to see it, to see that dumb, crazy, random idea that I had, that product there on store shelves, is so special. Especially because for me, that was my goal. I remember when I was little.
So obviously, it just gets more emotional from there. I mean, I was watching that video and I was just bawling.
Yeah.
Mostly because it's just man, we can do it. That's what it is. She's every time somebody breaks a little barrier or gets a little higher, and she's the type of person who completely shares her journey openly on Instagram, and it's to young Latina entrepreneurs or just to entrepreneurs in general, it's anything is possible with hard work, dedication,
yes,
and patience. And I mean, that's a lesson that Nipsey Hussle taught us. And I mean, I just think it's so beautiful to see her talking about it in such a raw way. And it really affected me. So that's why I want to give her Chingona of the Day, Chingona of the Year, Chingona of the Lifetime, because
yes,
she really just inspires girls like me to keep on going and what's possible.
Yes, I agree. Congratulations, Julissa.
Yes, go girl, go girl. So what I want to get into next is the American Dirt controversy. So this book is written by a woman named Jeannie Cummins. And I'm just going to open it up. What do you know about it? What have you heard?
That this lady wrote this book, and there's people upset about how she's portraying certain peoples and environments and because of her lack of experience in those areas. So... yeah, just the idea of someone writing some shit they don't really know about.
Yeah, she said her claim was that, well, I went to Mexico for a few weeks to do some research, so that's why my writing is justified.
Okay, I'm gonna let y'all go because I swear there's more in it that I, from the not being an artist side of it, mm-hmm. I think is a real thing. Like, I do think I'm very fucking judgmental, very opinionated.
You are.
You know that. But I do think there is something, I think there's something to someone who has the ability to tell a story and move people to find out more about it, even if they didn't experience it. And in the, and but the double-edged sword of that is that if that person isn't letting people know about, and it has to be discovered, then it's kind of fucked up because yeah. it looks like you were hiding it. But if someone's kind of open, like there was, you know, there are poets who tell great fucking stories and you're just like, that's a dope ass story.
And call it a persona.
Now, if she was
piece.
Saying it was her autobiography, I think I'd look at it in a way different kind of situation. But I think if you're writing, like, I think Stephen King is dope as fuck. I know he didn't fucking do any of this shit in there. Yeah. When they ask him what the scariest shit he ever said, scariest thing he's ever experienced, he goes, the scariest thing I ever could imagine is waking up and finding my kids dead. That's so he wrote about it, but he didn't have that shit happen. So I place value on someone's ability to move people with words. But then the other side of me is like, but if you're trying to be sneaky with the shit, then it's kind of whack. Mm-hmm. But I can't fully, I mean, I wasn't going to read it anyway.
Yeah, me either.
But you know what I'm saying? So,
so look,
the
it
people
says,
who would be moved, I could see them being pissed off even more than I would.
It says, the novel is a fast, frothing thriller about Lydia, a bourgeois Mexican bookseller, and her son, Luca, who flee to the United States to escape members of a drug cartel led by a bookish thug after the cartel kills her journalist husband in the novel's opening scene.
Wait, a bookish thug?
What?
The fuck
what
is a bookish
what?
Thug?
It says that. Listen,
a bookish thug?
In fleeing, Lydia and Luca are subjected to indignities and brutalities associated with the thousands of desperate people caught up in the migrant crisis. As Cummins says in an author's note, she wrote this book because she wanted readers to know that the people coming to our southern border are not one faceless brown mass, but singular individuals with stories and backgrounds and reasons for coming that are so unique. Cummins thinks we need more bridges than walls.
Wait, is she white?
So
I haven't seen a picture of the lady at all.
Let's pull one up for you.
Pull the picture up because I need to see who the woman is.
Española.
Because I think that plays a role in it. Because I saw an interview years ago, I remember with Antonio Banderas, and he said, he goes, Americans are Latinos. We're not. I'm Spanish. And there is a thing. There is a difference in how you're viewed.
That's her. So she's Puerto Rican. She was born in Spain. So the conversation, like, I don't know how it gets.
There's a whole lot of shit there.
Oh my God.
Being Puerto Rican and being born Woo! In Spain is a fucking thing.
But no, yeah, I get that. But it's just all, it's all been confusing. Like, there hasn't been one, because I read one thing where she said she identifies as Puerto Rican. And then another is telling me that she was born in Spain. But I mean, even so, this is a story about Mexico.
Yeah, that's.
Yeah.
Okay, first of all, she, at her party where she debuted
her book.
Oh, girl,
the party.
What really upset me was that she had centerpieces with
barbed wire.
Hey, like, I would have went to the
like,
body.
That is extremely offensive.
Of course it is extremely offensive,
and it's not just offensive. It's how would you think that, you know, these are my people in these cages. These are my gente
that are in
concentration camps and that are being treated with not even, you know, human rights. And so for her to profit. Go ahead.
I don't know. Like, I don't know. I feel like
to
I can
use
jump
it as
in
decor.
Shit and I don't want to jump in. But I think
do
there's
it.
So much in there because I do think the idea of, which is conversation I've had a lot about the Latinidad and Latinx and da-da-da-da-da. And I think all those things create these divisions and try to create, like, a monolith of people that they're not. So, like, being Puerto Rican is not being Mexican.
Yeah,
it's not being Spanish.
Right. Like,
it's
grouping all
Dominican,
Latinos together.
Not, right? But then when you're viewed as that, and, like, if you were to do an event, they would probably put that on there. Like, you are Latinx or Latina or whatever, right? So when you get labeled with these things, I think there's a part of some people who feel like they now have an ability to speak on things that they can't really, they don't really know shit about because they're under that gate. It's like being the only black motherfucker in a fucking meeting. And then all of a sudden they're like, so do black people really eat collard greens? And you're like, not everybody. You know what I'm saying? So, or walking through fucking Whole Foods, like, ah, the nigga in Whole Foods. Like, oh, fuck. Like, yeah. I'm the black dude in Whole Foods. And I'm just starving. It's the only shit I saw. So, like, you know what I mean? But then all of a sudden, they ask you questions like, these black eyed peas good for the, like, no, I don't know what the fuck black eyed peas
and ham hocks and shit. I think like, she was, before she became an author, she actually worked in the publishing world in New York for 10 years. So here's the thing. I believe that she probably had access to people like party planners who are so completely far removed from the actual content of what's in the book that they tried to match the cover of the book. And in the party planning world, because they have no concept of what's correct and wrong to Latinos,
right.
they're like, oh, well, I did my job. I just did the decor. Like,
they do not have the cultural competency.
That's the word that I didn't have.
They do not, and they have no business in there if they don't have
But if they, okay, so here's the other side is, do you think that they, fuck, how much do you fault someone who doesn't have the information? But well, is thinking if they're doing, if they think they're doing the right thing. It's like a white person who's like, I want to be an ally, but I don't really know how. But then they do something that they think is in the right, but then it's people like, what the fuck did you do that for? And they're like, I thought I was helping. So how do you fault, how can you, I don't know how much you fault the motherfucker who doesn't know the information when I kind of would place more of the blame on her, right, as the person who kind of should or is looked at as the fucking expert in that setting.
Mm-hmm.
Even if she isn't.
Because she was the closest to it.
She is the closest thing to it. So she should be the person who goes, oh, I don't know if you should put this shit here.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, well, when you have access to enough resources to hire somebody like a party planner, you also have enough resources to hire someone like a consultant.
Yes. A cultural consultant.
Yes. Yes. I just don't think that's how it happens in real life all the time. Even if that's the right step to make. It's not.
But if it's not what happens in real life and you consistently see that what happens when people don't hire a consultant is they get all this backlash. This lady canceled her book tour because she said she was afraid for her life. Yep. She canceled her book tour. Yeah.
Okay. Do you think there's any truth in it?
To be scared for her life?
Yeah.
No.
You don't think so in the way people have reacted to it? And the way, you know, people can be online?
They're making fun of her.
But you know how people can be though. You don't, and we don't know what she's getting.
But they're criminalizing us. They're criminalizing us.
Which I have a huge issue with.
Which is a big part of their safety. You know, being a scholar artivist, I get that a lot. You know what I'm saying? The first thing that they want to do to me is character assassinate me. And because I'm dangerous and because mm-hmm. I'm going to kill somebody.
Yeah.
And, you know, they because my face is brown, I don't look white. I look totally indigenous. And, like, this is a dangerous person. This is a dangerous brown person because she's not complying mm-hmm. with what we want the world to perceive as legit and valuable.
Yeah.
Well, and so it's this, like... Commodification mm-hmm. of the undocumented experience.
Exactly.
But like, so there was actually a lot of funny tweets.
We call it poverty pimping.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That's like some poverty pimp shit.
In poetry community, we call it pimping your trauma. Yeah. Yes. And that's a thing in every community.
Someone called her book that trauma porn.
Oh, yeah. That's real. So there's these funny tweets that I wanted to bring up just because we can't just argue the whole entire time. So there's like Crystal Marie, anime girl on Twitter. So everyone was like parodying her, how they would write their Latino novel. So she goes, writing my Latino novel, I shout pica pica in my cosplay, but my tia thinks my tongue caught fuego. Ay, mija, she throws her arms up like she's dancing in el barrio. Drink agua, I explain, it's Pikachu, and she calls it El Diablo Amarillo. Angry, I steal her
platanitos.
Like, I think these are funny because I don't know it because okay, so Felicia read me an excerpt of the actual book, and the reason why they're parodying the whole Spanglish thing is because she tried to do that in the book. Like, there's like really random moments where instead of just saying a thing in English, the whole book's in English, and then there'll be these really random moments of Spanish, which I think she thinks is what Spanglish is, but that's not what it is.
But that's what I'm saying. Right, when she becomes the fucking reference point, then she kind of has this false fucking confidence and liberty to go about fucking narrating the experience the way she feels like it would be. And that's the whack part. You know what I'm saying? Because that's what I'm saying. Like, it's a weird situation because you're like, if she don't fucking know, but then someone's giving her the fucking sword and like, you're going to lead the Mano. It's like, well, then I'm doing what I think is right, maybe. Mm-hmm. And, like, I don't know her from anybody, but what if she 100% believes this is the fucking thing? Then that's another fucking issue. So, I mean, there's so much.
Like Rachel Dolezal?
You know what I'm saying? And not, I mean, but there's, I think it's, yes, like Rachel Dolezal. Same kind of thing.
Like it's a whole.
But even in the Rachel Dolezal conversation, as fucked up as what that thing was, she did so much on the side of activism in NAACP.
She was like president of the NAACP at one point.
But I'm talking about what she actually put into place. She did so many fucking things, but then that dies because she was being fucking sneaky about it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So it's a fucked up.
So then the last part of what we're going to say about that is this. Actually, Sandra Cisneros, I was very taken aback when I saw this. I didn't understand, like, I don't know if it's out of context or whatever,
it's not out of context. She said that
she called people exagerados.
Exagerados.
So in the interview, Cisneros called people who have accused the book and author of exploiting traumatic moments in an effort to generate buzz exagerados. Instead, she praised Cummins' ability to turn issues about immigration and the border into a thriller that could change minds that Latino authors
like
her could not.
It's fucked up.
She says, it's going to be an audience who maybe is undecided about issues at the border. It's going to be someone who wants to be entertained, and the story is going to enter like a Trojan horse and change minds. And it's going to change the minds that perhaps I can't change, Cisneros said. Adding that she and Cummins and other immigration writers are all together working side by side to raise consciousness about this issue. She basically said that people were exaggerating and that if people are not going to listen to Latinos, might as well let a white lady write it. I don't know, but we'll, you know.
Well, it's a fucking thing, I'm telling you.
Look, I'm sympathetic for the fact that she's, you know, a writer and she gets to write about what she wants to write about, but you know, she also has to be culturally sensitive. She also has to have some direction as far as what she, you know, the as far as, you know, how or maybe how she might offend our community. And, you know, the fact that, you know, she canceled her book tour speaks volumes. And she might be, and people might be saying she's in danger, but that's not true. You know what I'm saying? Like, no one's putting her life in danger. People are upset.
And they're making fun of her. Like, that's the thing. Like, that it's more of a like, come on. It, like, when I first heard the whole thing, I was like, girl, bye. Like, that was my response. Like, and I laughed at the tweets. But, I mean, no, I don't believe her life is in danger for 1 second. And that's the whole thing. She tried to humanize the migrant experience in her words. She tried to humanize it and, like, oh, these are real people and this isn't that. But then when it came down to her canceling her book tour, they were people who were scary and going to hurt her.
But I think the language used adds to that. So even if no one's gonna do shit to her, I think when we talk in the language of violence, where everything is a violent act against the da-da-da, then she's being treated and she's being talked to with violent words. And even if someone's joking, if we're in a climate that everything is a violent act of da-da-da because I said this or I used this word, then all of a sudden she can, if she plays in that universe, go, well, now I'm feeling fucking threatened.
So this
even
is,
if it's bullshit.
This is
even
an if example it's bullshit. Of you the call-out culture and the call-out person versus the call-in culture.
That's what happens because of that culture. Now, she could be trying to, I don't know any of the conversations she's had with Cummins, but maybe she's trying to fucking, on the backside of it, try to explain shit like to her. She could be trying to educate her, but in front, she has to be like, hey, so, you know, it's good. And then she's like, hey,
and I mean, I kind of like, in defense of Sandra, because I mean, she is a hero to me, you know?
Yeah,
like,
Sandra
and so a lot of
legit,
us.
Yeah.
And so, but I think what happens is like, as you live longer, you eventually live long enough to see your heroes disappoint you in some way because they're human. And
also, she's
a boomer. So, I mean, I feel like she's more about, like, let's just get in there somehow.
We call them Chicanosauruses.
Okay, boomer.
Because like, they're so hooked in the old ways. I'm not saying that we call her that, but I'm saying this mentality where it's stuck in that time. And we need to move out of that. And we need to, you know.
But how many people you think in her circle are doing that? She's held in such high regard that I doubt everybody's going, bitch, you crazy. What the fuck are you thinking? You know what I'm saying? It's like, to me, like, the other side of it, like, for me on this end would be, like, Tyler Perry shit. Like, all the people who ride for him, I'm like, how the fuck do you not see this is terrible?
That's
and this
real.
Makes us look terrible. Yet people I see, like, Oprah, like, ah, like, okay. Really?
Yeah.
Man, this is horrible.
Yeah.
Everything about this is not making us look good. But, again, that fear, that way of thinking is that we got in.
Yeah.
Got in, we built something, and it's like, yeah, like, but now we look like fucking...
Right.
Step and fetch it vibe. You know what I'm saying? It's like...
So that's the thing. So she actually, Sandra Cisneros, actually, her house on Mango Street actually got adapted into a TV show.
Yeah, HBO.
Yeah, and so that's, she says, I write because the world we live in is a house on fire and the people we love are burning. Cisneros told Dateline, television has grown up in the last 20 years and now is the time to tell our stories. I mean, for me, I think that I was extremely excited when I heard that. I still am. I'm extremely excited to see, because that book was the first book
that I read in school that
even had anything to do with anything like Latinas.
Us, exactly.
Or anybody like that. And so I was just like excited, but I don't know, to hear her say the things she said about that. And then also with the Oprah thing, Oprah actually put American Dirt on her book club. Like I said, you live long enough to eventually see some of your heroes disappoint you in some ways. And, you know, I think even that goes back to the Kobe thing. Like, there's a part of his past that there are some people that can't move past that because that's their experience. Like, they're actually survivors of rape and sexual assault. And so they never, after that happened, they were never able to look at him the way everyone else eventually saw him as this, you know, legendary hero. Basketball player, hero, person that was motivational, inspirational, and those... It's interesting because those two things can be happening at the same time. He can exist in two worlds because people have different experiences of him. And it's not for me to say which one is wrong or right. Because if you are a person that's a survivor of sexual assault, how dare I even jump into the conversation of how you should feel?
Right.
You know? And then also, too, then there's me who hasn't seen my boyfriend cry, like, in 3 years. That it was, like, brought out something out of him that I was like, oh, my gosh, this wasn't just, like, a... any guy, right. For him, his experience of it was completely emotional because that was his childhood hero.
Yeah.
And so I think that those two conversations can exist at the same time. So I just wanted to, like, acknowledge that. Yeah. But I want to jump into my Shihan interview. So I have lots of questions for you, Shihan, because like before we, when you first came in, I was trying to say that, and I can't look at you. It's so weird.
Don't worry. I won't look at you. We're even.
So I wanted to use this podcast so far. So far, what I have noticed about how I use this podcast is that I use it to talk to people who I consider my teachers, and people who have, whether they know it or not, have, you know, significantly impacted my growth as a, whatever it is, a human or a writer or just in general. And so I chose you to ask, and I was nervous to ask you, even though I know I shouldn't be, because you're just my brother. But I mean, I was nervous because you were always someone who I looked up to when it came to the way you present your art. Like, you don't just throw anything out there, you know, and that's something you have always even preached to us, is like, you know, take pride in your work, and also, like, just don't put anything janky out in the world, you know? And so I waited until I wasn't in my room with my microphone until I got into this space to be able to be like, look, Shihan, come, let me interview you. Let me, like, tell you how I feel about how you've impacted me, and just get Lori and more about you on record. So how would you introduce yourself?
A father of three and a husband of one, and that's it.
And that is something I actually want to ask you about, because I think a lot of people who may have had your career would start that introduction differently. And why do you start it the way you start it?
I mean, because that's the most important thing to me is my family. So, and I think, like, I'm big on media. And I think, like, when being put in front of a microphone or in front of things, I think it's super important to speak on behalf of the things that I felt were missing growing up. And I felt like being Black, and even though, you know, I'm Black and Puerto Rican, but growing up and being looked at as a certain thing, like, I felt like the examples of that weren't there. And I thought it was always important that when I was given an opportunity to speak on behalf of that, like, I am a father, a husband, I exist, and I'm Black and Latino, and this is what it is. You know what I mean? Like, they exist. And so that, to me, is more important. Also, because I was raised by a single Black father, which I grew up when it was like, my dad wasn't there, fuck that. And it's like, nah, I had that. So I want to speak about that experience. And yeah. So that's why I think I start with that.
So you are an internationally known poet. Like, that's just true, because you've been, I just a little bit of research, and but I've also just done research by knowing you all these years. And so you, I watched a talk of you in Nigeria.
Oh, word.
Yeah, I watched a talk of you in Nigeria, and then I watched another interview of you talking about your life. So I wanted to also talk about, like, my first memory of you. So my first memory of you, I was in eighth grade, and I got asked
and
one
I'm
time.
Eight. Go ahead.
I got asked what my my most prized possession was, and my answer was my TiVo box. And they were like, your TiVo box? because that was, I don't know if you guys remember what TiVo is. Yeah. Where, like, the first thing you could stop and record stuff. And the reason why my TiVo box was the most important thing for me was because I had recorded all of the episodes of Deaf Poetry. And so Deaf Poetry on HBO was the first time I had been introduced to poetry off the page. And that was like a whole world-shaking moment because I did not know that it could sound like anything other than boring, to be honest.
Right.
Like, I just didn't, it was never brought to life for me. Until that moment, I remember watching you on there and just really impacted by your delivery. Mm-hmm. That was always something that I was like, how does he do that? How does he memorize everything? And like, you never hold back. Like, you never half-ass it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
About the non-half-assing? Because my belief is that the majority of shit, people are very comfortable with half-ass. That's the biggest thing lacking in our social structure is consistency. And so that's why people are so comfortable with half-ass shit, because shit's always messed up. And that's why shit is the way it is now. And I was raised not to settle for something being half-ass. And also, I spent time on it. I don't want to spend time writing and trying to commit to memory and all this shit and then do a whack-ass job and have people like, you fucking memorize that shit? Like, that's not where I was. So, going all out, showing emotion. Like I said, like, I remember on that show, and even after it aired and was on and it was done, I remember people coming to, like, when you cried or you did it, like, to see a father talking about his kids and crying or talking about his wife, and that was important. Like, in the moment, I was writing it because all those things were happening in real time. Mm-hmm. All the pieces that I did were all happening as maybe a month before they were read and that kind of shit. And so it was still real and super part of how I was going about living in that moment, you know, and even though those moments still have meaning, it doesn't mean the same. Like, I'm not going to walk around and be like, I want to love, like, that's not happening anymore, even if I still have that feeling. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So, yeah, I'm big on that. And I think I was lucky. I think the first time I performed on that show, on HBO with that show, I did, you know, we shoot two poems, they air one. But there was one of the few times that my family was there. So I looked, everywhere I looked, I saw my father, I saw my best friend growing up, I saw my sister, I saw my titi, I saw, like, and everywhere I looked. And then, like I said, I'm a Knicks fan, and Patrick Ewing was in the front row, and I was like, oh, shit! And I can't react to that, so I'm just like, oh, my God!
For which performance?
For Love Like.
I want a love like me thinking of you, thinking of me, thinking of you type love, or me telling my friends more than I've ever admitted to myself about how I feel about you type love, or hating how jealous you are, but loving how much you want me all to yourself type love, or seeing how your first name just sounds so good next to my last name.
And everyone was there, and then for Father's Day, like I said, Patrick Ewing's sitting in the front row, and I'm like, oh shit, that's fucking Patrick Ewing. And I'm like looking at shit, and my dad's there, and he raised me, so I'm talking about being a father and what that was like, and having to be on the road.
Road trips make my babysitter see my baby more than I do, and it's hard, right? Then come painful reminders like questions was even harder to explain answers like, Daddy, do you still love me? I thought I'd die when she asked me that.
And so when it was done, I was just like, oh, fuck, all these people. And I'm saying bye to everybody who's there. And then they come up and they're like, someone wants to talk to you. And then they go, and fucking Patrick Ewing was like, dude, you made me cry. And I was like, oh, shit, I made Patrick Ewing cry. Like, I was so fucking geeked on that. And so, but again, it's because I committed fully to what it is. And I never wanted to put on the mask or the act, just because I think growing up with my father the way I did and the way he was as far as disciplining and, you know, I grew up doing martial arts and all this shit. So it was very important to you know, give direct contact, look people in the eye, and make sure they know that when I'm telling them something that it's for them. It's not like some... And so all this stuff is happening. It's like, no, I want you to know I'm talking to you. It's like someone saying, I love you like this. Mm-hmm. And someone saying, I love you while looking you in the face. Like, you know, when someone's giving you the real thing and when someone's kind of just going through the motions. And so I never wanted someone to take what I had to say as anything less than the truth and genuine. And so that's what that was, I think.
Yeah. One of my other first memories I have of you is before you even knew me, before I ever said hello to you. I went to the Poetry Lounge and on my 21st birthday, and you and Poetry sang me happy birthday.
Yay!
And you didn't even know who I was or whatever, but I was like, this is crazy. Like, that was a moment for me. But it was kind of like a foreshadowing into kind of how eventually I would be spending a large amount of my life there. Mm-hmm. And it was after that that my friends stopped coming with me. And I was like, but I still want to keep on going. But nobody wants to come with me. And it was that was how I learned to even go anywhere by myself. Mm-hmm. I started going there. And then you eventually make friends and in line. And then you eventually don't have to wait in line. And then it's like a whole process that people go through right. to become part of the Poetry Lounge community. And I remember it was a place where I could soak up things. I could mm-hmm. soak up people's experiences. I could soak up the way they write. But then it was also a place where it kept you on your toes. Like you, every time someone would give a new poem, you would want to give yours, and like it would keep you writing. And it was just this time in my life where I felt like it was like a creative incubator, you know?
Oh yeah, and especially because you came in, and then a collective was created in that. So there was like a group of y'all. So y'all all got to inspire each other and be part of that, which is what the lounge was when we started. It was like a group of friends, like, oh shit, like, oh, that was incredible. Like, I don't want to be the one that's not doing some shit. So you yeah. keep on fucking, and it keeps you motivated to keep doing it. So you're constantly being inspired by the people you're surrounded by, which I think is important in any kind of world you're going to exist in or any circle space you're going to be in, because it's like the whole, I don't want to be the smartest motherfucker in the room. I don't want to be the dumbest either. Like, I kind of want to,
yeah,
constantly find ways to grow.
Like, I first started performing poems, I was in college, so my mind was in essay mode. I don't know if you remember this, but I used to have some long ass poems, like, because they weren't poems, they were essays. Like, but I didn't know how to switch gears. And it was until, like, people would take me aside and be like, have you ever heard of editing? And that was like, that was where it was happening. That was where the learning was happening. And if it wouldn't have been for getting stuff wrong, I wouldn't have learned how to, you know, edit or learned how to do things that are necessary in order to make poetry and writing a career. Mm-hmm. And so it's like you have to be open to, you know, not doing it or sucking for a while. Mm-hmm. And I remember that was something you explained to us, because I also remember one time coming out of the lounge after and not knowing who to ask this question to, but because I hadn't written in a few months. Mm-hmm. And I came up to you and I was like, Shion, I haven't written in a few months. Like, is that normal? And you kind of like laughed and you were like, there have been years I haven't written. And you kind of just like set me at ease to like let me know that just because you haven't written in a few months does not make you any less of a poet. That's something that what you said. And that moment just stuck with me because I started to feel like in a place where there's so many extremely talented people like on a weekly basis that are producing work. And if you're not, you can start to feel some type of way.
Mm-hmm. And
And I remember you telling me that. Is that still true?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
And so tell me about like the years you didn't write or expand on that.
Well, I think a couple things led into it. And the years, I know the time periods specifically. It was when the Deaf Poetry thing was happening and when we were on tour and having to read the same 5 poems every day for 50 something dates. And you're like, this is not inspiring at all. And then you get off and you get in a tour bus and you're in a fucking thing that's like a casket and you sleep in this little fucking thing like this. It's like 2x3 or whatever. And it's like, I'm in a fucking coffin. And literally I'm like, my shit is dying. My art is full on dying in this fucking tour bus. And then I get off and I read the same things and I'm trying to write and I can't think of shit because I'm just frustrated with everything going on, even though I'm grateful for the opportunity to travel the fucking world reading poems and tell people my story. Like, that shit was great. But at the same time, like, I can't think at all of anything. Or, like, I'd have ideas and I'd write and I'm like, rabbit, cat, monkey, this is terrible. And then I'm like, fuck. And then I'm more frustrated at myself, right? Yeah. So then, because all this shit goes on in your head, right? So all the shit, and that's why I think the writing thing's important or having some kind of art, like, outlet is important, because with all the shit going on and then all the shit's in your head, if you never let it out, it's just in your head and it's going to constantly just clusterfuck and become a big ass problem.
And torment
you. And you start to doubt shit. And I was like, oh my God. And I just remember just all that time going by and then being on the road. And then I remember the kids being born and those were the moments. It was like, oh. And I just remember, you know, writing about that moment and like writing about what it was like to see that. And then, you know, taking the kids to see my dad because he lived, you know, in New York and we were out here and then my grandmother and like all these things. And then I start thinking about the moments. And so when the tour ended, I was like frustrated. And then finally everything kind of came back around and I made a concerted effort to not go on the road as much anymore. And I was like, you know, cause at that point I was gone 100 or so days a year. And that sucks. Like, it was great financially, I was like, oh shit, this is fantastic. Bought a house on Poetry. Like, that shit was dope. But then I'm like, fuck, like, I'd rather be home. So made the effort to kind of transition from being a performer to writing more and figuring out other outlets to get my shit to. I was able to like figure it out. And then I started looking at it as separate from just the passion of writing, my passion for writing, to it's also a job now. And then it changes what it is, you know? So working for a company and be like, oh, we need you to do this by this. I'm like, oh shit. I don't have the luxury of being like, next week.
Not feeling inspired today.
Yeah. So I'm like, okay, I'm forced to kind of do it. So yeah.
Another memory that I have is one time for no reason at all, you came up to me, you put your arm around me and you were like, I'm glad you're here. And you were like, this family needed you. And
I have always wanted to ask you what just happened before that
or like why did you say that?
I think it was I like people who talk and aren't afraid to say things, and I felt and I feel like that space can get way out of hand if you don't have people to ground what's going on in it, which almost can lead back to that fucking Cummings thing. Like, if you don't have someone going, hey, and a voice of reason going through it, it just becomes some fucking problem. So I was like, oh shit, this is dope to have somebody who is good in what they're saying. And even if you're not confident at the moment, I'm like, she fucking is going for it. Like, she's believing what it is. You know what I'm saying? And I think that was important. But, you know, I feel like in LA, there's so much going on. I think in the lounge, there's a lot of stuff going on because, you know, you have 200 people watching you read poems. That's fucking a lot for somebody when most poetry spots got 20 people or whatever. So 200 people fucking surrounding you, that becomes the bug. And people be like, they be addicted. Like, oh my God. And to see...
Because it's a rush when you get up
it's
there.
It's a fucking super rush. And to see people not affected and still go through what that is, I'm like, oh, this is like important. You know, and I don't talk to a group of people because I'm just... Yeah. I've always been that person.
That's why I think that was memorable for me, because you don't waste your words. You don't just throw words out. And so when you say something, he let you think about it before you say it, and you mean it. And so even the smallest kind of like compliment from you is a big deal. I have more questions.
Please.
Okay. So the one thing we do have in common is that we're both mixed.
Yeah.
And so I want to talk about what that has meant for you. Like, super general.
In general terms, I mean, growing up, okay, I'd have to break it up in two. I'd have to break it up from being in New York and then growing up here, right? So in New York, it's not a thing. I was never asked what I was in New York ever. In my life, I've never been asked what I was in New York. When I moved to LA, first people I met, what are you? When you mix with something? And I'm like, LA got a thing for color. And then also being mixed and being Black and Puerto Rican, in New York, my dad... because my mother left when I was 5, I was about to be 6. My dad was very big on making sure I was around that side of the family, also because I had an extremely small family on his side. It was just my grandmother. So he would send me to Puerto Rico to be with my grandparents. I'd be at my titi's house like over the weekends. And my best friend, Andres, he's Puerto Rican and Mexican, which is kind of random now saying that, because I didn't meet a Mexican till I moved to California. Which is kind of crazy. Because now I go to New York, there's Mexicans there. But when I grew up, you'd be like, a Mexican? Like on TV? You know, like one of them, like a Filipino. Like in New York, you'd be like a Filipino or a Samoan. You're like a Samoan. Yeah. You come here and move to, you know, I lived in Torrance when I first moved here. And Carson's right there. I'm like, oh, these are Samoans. They're all here in Carson. They live in Carson.
There's a huge Samoan community.
So it is a difference. And I think moving here, I was very comfortable in who I was, because of who I was raised around. And I think a lot of people have issue with identity. And that's why there's all those other issues too. Because I think a lack of identity in who you are and becomes other shit and branches out and becomes problems in other places in your life. So when I moved here, I was comfortable being like, oh, I'm Black and Puerto Rican. I'm Black and Puerto Rican. And then I'm Black. Like, I know how people view me. You know what I mean? And I also know, like, being here and having Van Cleef as my last name. And then I go somewhere and they're like, Shehan Van Cleef. And they expect a different person to show up. And then I show up and they're like, oh, you're Shehan Van Cleef. And I'm like, confused. Yeah, you know, and that's some shit. And that happened. As a matter of fact, that shit happened the day before yesterday at my kid picking up my son from school, where, you know, it's a buzzer to let you in. And he was behind me. So a lady didn't see him standing behind me. And she's like, you have a kid here? And I'm like, And I wanted to go, I'm sorry, your husband doesn't help. Or you don't have a dude. You know what I mean? Like, I could have been the asshole, but I'm like, this is my son right here. I'm sorry. But yes. Yeah. You know, but I'm that or pick. I remember picking up a check a couple of years ago in Palmdale from the program I teach out there. And I went, and they were super cool, always on the phone. And one day I was like, hey, I'm in the area. Can I stop by? Because I need to hand you the paperwork. And they said, yeah, sure. And I came, and they were like, who are you? And I said, oh, Shion Van Cleef. They're like, oh, and they called the person out, and they were like, I'll take that. And I was like, wow, you were super cool over the fucking phone and on the emails.
Yeah.
And you see, so, you know, but I'm still very comfortable, and I don't let it become a thing. Like, it's not something I'm hung up on. So if someone, whatever, and me also, because of my dad, like, understanding Spanish, being horrible speaking it and not speaking it at all because I didn't have to, but also knowing that and being in spaces where people would talk and I'm just sitting there like, wow, you just do not know. I know everything you're saying about me right now. And then you're going to turn around and be nice.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? So identity, I'm very comfortable in who I am. But I don't say mixed. Like, I'm black and Puerto Rican. Like,
yeah.
Or I'm black or whatever it's going to be. And that's it. Because I think now there's so many different, you know, it's like the Puerto Rican, and then like there's the white and black Puerto Ricans, there's the Mexican, there's
like the ones who think
that, and there's so many of those things. It's like, I'm not trying to play that game.
Yeah.
Like, I understand those are real things, but I'm good with who I am. Mm-hmm. And I'll call you everything you want to be called, but my shit is very here.
Yeah.
I know what it is.
So you've always been someone who has just like a very vocal opinion about.
Yes.
Like, whatever it is that your opinion is, it's like you're very sure of it. And then there are some times where I have talked to you and you're like, I don't have an opinion on that yet.
Oh, yeah.
And so I want to know, like, where does that come from? Like, where does kind of like the way your wisdom is set up, you know, like, where does that come from?
I'd say a lot of it is based in how my father raised me and my grandmother helping when she was able to. And my father is, you know, a lot of people, when we're around each other, they don't see the commonalities, but a lot of people are like,
dragon.
Oh, you like your fucking father. Like,
yeah.
You're very opinionated. I walk the same, which my daughter walks like me. She's like, I can't believe I walk like Grandpa Blue Dragon. Like, you know? But he was, you know, martial arts is a thing. It's a discipline thing. So I think discipline being the foundation for how everything grows out of, like, I'm grounded in what this is, and I don't want to waste anybody's time. I don't want people wasting my time. So I make sure, like, I have something to say or that I'm saying something of value, and like, even if I'm fucking around, because I enjoy seeing people smile and laugh and shit, because I think people are so serious, and there's a lot of serious shit out there. You know, I remember a conversation with Sonia Sanchez like years ago, and she was like, I don't have time to write poems about like flowers and shit. And I'm like, but then one of my favorite poems is Nikki Giovanni, and she's like, I love that you write about being a father and love.
She said that to you?
Yeah, and she wrote a note to my mom. Like,
oh,
and
my thought, God.
And
you
to me,
frame
it was
it?
Like, really, I don't know what my mom did with it. I hope she still has it. I've never asked my mom what she did, but I gave her the note. But I was like, yeah, like, I think it's important to make someone laugh. Of all the shit, why would I not want you to laugh and be okay to get through the thing? Like, I don't want you to be constantly bombarded by just fucked up stuff. Like, the whole trauma pimping thing. Like, I don't want you, and even though someone's not throwing it at you, sometimes you can get engulfed in it and just stay in it. And it's like, nah, I'd rather enjoy. Like,
that's,
I don't want
to
see my friends fucked up.
That's what you also have, like, you serve a purpose at the lounge. You serve that purpose. Like, you can instantly go from talking about something really serious to laughing and joking and, like, you know, in between poems. And you're great at commenting on the poems. Like, the last time I was there, just recently, remember that one poem about the, Jesus, I can't even say this. There was a social worker there who did a poem, and she talked about a little baby being,
yes,
with the curling iron. And
right.
I just, like, I can't even, but you got up there and you just, is it because you feel responsible for what's happening in the space that you need to comment on it? Like, cause you, I feel like you took that and you needed to comment on it because it was a moment for everyone in there that they were all kind of like, what did we just hear?
I do think I say things because I realize that the conversation doesn't continue after someone gets off stage.
Yeah.
So someone could leave you some shit like, this is the most fucked up thing that ever happened in my life. Good night. And you're like, what the fuck did you just leave me with?
Yeah.
And I don't want that. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it's necessary to kind of put...
Process a little bit.
Put something. And put something also into context so that there's kind of some understanding around it. So, yeah, I think that's kind of why.
So my favorite
Shihan poem is your family, the My Family poem.
Mm-hmm.
And it specifically because it resonates with me because there's a part in it where you say, my mother cut in and out of my life as if she were a DJ, that part. And I really, really relate to that because that was exactly the same way it was for me and my dad. Mm-hmm. And I also kind of put him on a pedestal because of it. And so every time I did see him, it was like the kind of the whole thing where you said she was the hottest tickets in town, you know, that I never had tickets to go see. And that was so I felt like we experienced the same type of thing, but we the results were different. And so I want to know, like, what did that teach you? Does it affect the way you parent?
Does it affect? It does to a certain degree because obviously, when you're young, you don't know the reasoning behind why your parents do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't want and don't want my kids to not know. Now, they are my kids. We're not fucking like best friends hanging out, and they should know there's fucking boundaries and that. But I also think in regards to how I viewed my dad never, even when she left, never said anything fucked up about my mom leaving. Never was like, oh, that motherfucker was that bitch, but never. And it's my guess, he would have been pissed if I had said something fucked up.
Yeah.
And I remember my grandmother saying the same thing. She's like, you know, some people have reasons to do what they do, and that's kind of what it is, you know? And it's like, I don't know what she's gone through, and I'm not going to hold that shit against her because I don't want to be trying to fix a fucking relationship at 70, you know, and be like, I wish I would have told you that. I just wish you were around. Like, I'm not going to be fucked up and that kind of stuff. And I feel like with my kids, I'm very truthful with my kids. And I talk to my kids the way I talk in general. So I'm not like, I don't curse around my kids. Like, my kids
know. Yeah, you don't have like a parent voice.
What's up?
You're the same person.
And I think they see and they can experience my parents how they're going to experience them. Like, I don't want them looking at my mom any kind of way. So we take them over and they get to hang out with Uma and do the whole fucking thing. And then Grandpa Black Dragon does what he does. And they get to have their, like, so Grandma,
like, they create
dragons,
their
like,
own relationship.
And that's fine. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And that's the thing I learned with my dad. Like, you just kind of, it's going to be what it is. No matter how hard I try, like, the whole, like, intent doesn't mean shit. It's how people take it. So I'm not going to have, you know, I have intention behind things, but also I know just because I want it to be a certain thing isn't going to be that way. So I kind of let shit kind of be. I want my kids to be experienced in what life is, which is why I, especially with Lonnie, like early on, I took my daughter to the lounge all the time because I want her to see the stories of what it is.
Yeah.
Like, that's why I'm against, I mean, it sounds fucked up saying I'm against private schools, but I'm kind of against private schools because I want my kids to be surrounded by people they're going to interact with in the real world.
Yeah.
And I don't want to have them
like
live
in these.
Like,
it's too sheltering.
I don't want kids to live in these fucking bubbles that all of a sudden the bubble get burst and they're like, what the fuck? This is the world? And I'm like, I'm sorry. I should have did a better job. You know what I mean? I never want that shit
to happen.
Shouldn't
have protected you so much.
We go to a haunted house together and I go, so right around this corner, there's going to be a guy who jumps out. And then right after that, there's going to be a girl who grabs your leg. Then it takes the fucking fun out of what the fuck life is. Mm-hmm. So I can't warn you of everything, which is how I view my kids. A poet friend of mine, Stacey Ann Chin, she said she wanted her kids to believe in the boogeyman so they had something to fucking face, some adverse thing they had to overcome. So she wasn't going to tell them that's not, if they believed it, she's going to let them believe it until they figure out how to get the fuck over it or face it. Uh-huh. And so those things I think are real for me.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier Sonia Sanchez and Nikki Giovanni. And so did you got to meet them on the set of Deaf Poetry, or was it in another context?
Both of them I met in and out of. When Nikki Giovanni gave me the note was at Deaf Poetry.
Yeah.
The Sonia Sanchez thing was in Pittsburgh somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I always remember you saying that people don't even know their favorite poet's favorite poet.
Oh, yeah.
But I know that yours is Rumi, right?
Yeah.
And so how did you discover Rumi and why is he your favorite? Well, first, he's not like a modern day poet. That's
right,
like
it's a 14th century, like Persian, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think to me, I was just exposed to a bunch of writers like junior high, where I had a teacher who just exposed me to a bunch of different writers. And that was something that came up. And I just think part of it has to do with the translation, because I think sometimes the wrong translator can fuck up a poem from another language, you know. And so the right translator, and I just liked the conciseness and like the streamlining of the story, where I was like, ah, I get that. Mm-hmm. I like that. That's the way to say it. The whole make it plain, just make it understandable, because the Dr. Seuss is just as important as fucking Shakespeare. You know what I mean?
That's like, real talk.
That I think you need the blocks. Like when people are like, oh, they don't understand. It's like, you're gonna fault somebody for not having the knowledge you have? Like what the fuck kind of thinking is? That's like some conqueror vibe shit. Like, oh, you don't know, so we gonna take advantage of the motherfucker. Like, nah.
Yeah.
Sometimes you gotta give them the info. So I just liked Rumi a lot in the language used. And so, yeah.
And I know DPL started in Dante's living room, right? Yeah. And you were living with them at the time.
Yep.
And
in the living room.
And it grew into this LA iconic spot that, you know, it's like LA's best kept secret, but it's like not really a secret to those of us who actually know about it. How has it been? Like, what has that taught you? Seeing something grow from something so small to something so much a part of the fabric of so many people's lives. Like, what does that feel like?
I mean, it feels good. And I think it took a long time to try and look at it and what it meant, because we were just doing it just to do it. Like, it was like friends hanging out. Like, what can we do to get together more? Let's do this every Tuesday.
You were
Tuesday.
A rapper when you first started, right?
When I first, well, at that time I was signed, yeah. But I was still writing my poetry, which to me are two different disciplines completely. Because none of my poems rhyme. So there's definitely a different how I look at them. But yeah, I was fucking, we were trying to find ways to kind of like hang out with each other. And you know, I lived in the living room. It was like a 3-bedroom house. It was Manny, one of the cousins. He lived in the dining room. I had the living room. And when we did the lounge, I had to move all my shit out the living room and set up the poetry shit. But what, why not, you know, all of a sudden there's like 75 people in your house and then they're in other rooms and you're like, oh, we can't have this here no more. Mm-hmm. But I think what it said to us was that people are looking for family. And I think it's a very vulnerable thing to allow people inside of your home. Mm-hmm. And I think when we did that and people were coming, it meant something more to them than we were thinking it meant. Because for us, it was just like, oh, we're doing some shit. But they were like, yo, like we're going to see this. And we're getting to see them in their regular settings. Because when it was over, we didn't leave. It's, I put my fucking bed and shit and my sheets. Yeah. And like, I go back to regular house shit. So seeing that was a big thing. And I think that's what has made the lounge last. It's like it has this family thing. As big as it is, it's still a very intimate kind of setting. And the people who go are connected to that and wanting to find what that family is for them, regardless of how they see family. You know, better family don't mean perfect. It just means, you know, whatever you're looking for.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Mm-hmm. Your dad is obviously the Black Dragon, which is a big deal. Mm-hmm. And I know that martial arts has been a part of your life always, but what are the larger lessons that you learned from martial arts?
I mean, fuck. My dad had it's called the Chinese Goju Virtues, right? It was, his style was called Chinese Goju that he created. And the virtues, to me, were a poem, right? So it was, Chinese Goju is our secret, I bear no arms. May God help me if I ever have to use my art. Love is our law, truth is our worship. Form is our manifestation. Conscience is our guide. Peace is our shelter. Nature is our companion. Order is our attitude. Beauty and perfection is our life, right? And that, those things, I think, all play a role in how, each of those things plays in how I interact and how I go about certain things, because they all mean and can be attributed to my art, to my family, to my day-to-day living. And yeah, I never thought of it like when I was a kid as a poem. It was just something we had to do in fucking karate class. But I think all those things and the discipline. Yes. Discipline of, I don't need to fucking act a fool to be heard or seen or blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, I don't know. Just make sure it's worth doing. Don't waste your time. And just like movement with martial arts. It's like all this shit, you tire yourself out. And there's a scene in the Dark Knight, in the Batman movie, is Dark Knight when he's fighting Bane and shit, and Bane says, you fight like a young man, and though it's admirable, it's not practical, right? Mm. So putting everything into everything will tire you out, and the long game is important.
Like to know what to give energy to and what not.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
it like taught you more of a long game mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of the long game, you're the first person who I ever spoke to. I remember we were sitting at Toe Rung, and in the booth, and I was like, what are you doing? And you were investing on that app. And it was the first time I had ever in my life, like, heard someone next to me, like an actual person that I actually respect what they have to say. Because you hear people say that all the time, like, yeah, what you need to be doing with your money is you need to be investing. You need to be, you know, thinking long term about your retirement, blah, blah, blah. It didn't become real until you said it. And so I remember that day because now that was years ago. And now today I have an investment account.
See? Shit's important, dude. Especially because if you don't have the knowledge, you don't know it exists. Sometimes it's important just to see it. You're like, oh, it's possible, or we could do it. But if you don't, you're just like continuing. And as an artist, there's no fucking
retirement plan.
So you got to invest your own shit and put your money in all that. Yeah.
Yeah. I own stock in Disney, Nike, like things that I actually wear or do. I was like, that's kind of how I'm going to make my decision. Like Netflix, watch it every day. So that's how I made my financial decision. But I'm such a hard-headed person that it had to take someone who I respect to say it for me to be like, well, I know Shion don't bullshit, so trust. Let me look into it.
That's trust.
And I did. And now I have an investment account, and I just wanted you to know that.
That's good.
So
that's good.
The next thing I want to ask is, what has being a teacher taught you at Phoenix High School and being out there? Give my listeners a little intro into you know, what kind of school that is and
so
what you do out there.
Phoenix High School is a school out in Palmdale. It is an alternative high school. Kids who are... have been kicked out of every other school. They are either on house arrest or on probation, and they are required to wear black, white, or gray. There's no logos allowed on campus. No tech is allowed on campus. And, you know, it is, to me, you know, they're searched before they come onto campus, but they're searched out on the street, which I think is kind of fucked up because people walking by see kids being searched, and then they get viewed as the problem, and they continue to carry that marker around with them. We started this poetry program going on 4 years now. It's about getting them to tell their stories, because I also believe like their stories, because they're out in Palmdale, it's out of sight, out of mind for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So they don't see it, so they don't think it's a thing that actually exists. And so I want people to know that. So I tell the students all the time about how their stories are important and they're valid. And I know young people, for the most part, aren't asked about their stories often or their opinions about shit because they're kids and they don't know shit, or you ain't experienced anything, so you don't really know what's up. But I know they do, in the same way I explained to them this week that, you know, sometimes I come there and I see some kids fucking sleeping, and I don't want anyone sleeping while I'm fucking giving my discussion, but I also know that this might be the only time that they feel comfortable enough to lay mm-hmm. their fucking head down. And yeah, I don't want you sleeping in my class, but sometimes I will fucking let that pass because you've told me the story about outside of here and what goes on, and you're constantly up and wondering where you're going to go. And so I want you to have that. And so we do a breakfast club, which is to teach them how to make fucking breakfast. Cause we ask the students at the school, how many of them eat before they come to school? And like three kids raise their hand and say, yeah, well, we need to teach you how to make some basic shit. It don't have mm-hmm. to be the fancy shit, just some eggs, some bacon. They fucking grated fucking hash browns and pancakes, and they fucking cook. And they get to feel good about that, you know? And I think seeing that, and I think one of the kids last semester said, you know, it just feels good just eating and not doing anything else. Like just sitting with somebody and building, like sitting around a table
breaking bread.
Talking to somebody, and that's it.
Yep.
And it goes, and none of us, and most of them wouldn't talk to each other or didn't fuck with each other outside of that. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, people who never would say anything to each other are sitting there and like talking about stuff. And I'm like, that shit feels good, you know? And so we teach them to play chess because it's important.
Nice.
Learn about strategy and learn about like what the board is and, you know, taking over real estate, you know, like what this fucking game is and how life is that. And mm-hmm. that, and then they get their basic courses. But I think those things are all important because... I think, you know, a couple years ago, they won the district chess tournament. And I think that was important mm-hmm. for the people out there who thought they were just the fucking kids, the fucked up kids over at that school. It's like, yeah, he came with his fucking anklet and whooped you in some fucking chess.
How'd that shit
feel?
Dope.
You know what I'm saying? Like, how'd that feel? You know? Mm-hmm. And so I want them to take pride in who they are. But that's, look, being a teacher is difficult as fuck. I'm only there 2 days a week. Sitting and being a teacher, a counselor, a friend, there's so many things you need to be to these kids for the most part.
Ooh.
That it is so much, and it can be overwhelming sometimes. You can feel like it's not gonna happen. Like you can feel like it's as much work as I do. Like I hope it fucking works, but knowing the other 20 something hours, the other 20 hours I'm not in their day, mm-hmm. shit is gonna be going down.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And how you start paying attention to kids in a way that, even though I have my own kids, those kids are not raised the way my kids are. And so I'm like talking to them, and I know those notice them sabotage shit because they'd rather hurt you than because they're so used to being hurt. So they'll do something to fuck up something so then they can put it on you and just be away from it.
Clean.
And you're like, wow, this is some shit. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I'm big, you know, this is the may I hug you? That culture, like I'm, you know, I grew up, like I said, in New York, you hug and kiss people when you see them. Like, hey, kiss on the cheek, da da da. Here, it's like, can I touch you? And I hug those kids at the school. Like, yeah. I go, come here. Let me, and then I ground, they're like, and at first they're like, and I go, come on. And then after a while now, give me a hug, and they give me a hug. And it's like, that's important, you know? And it's important also as a dude, also to show them that and not feel any kind of way about it. Like, you know, especially early into being, are you gay? It's like, no, I actually think it's important for you to feel some hugging.
Yeah.
And I do like this. It makes it better. You know what I'm saying? Whatever it is. Like, I think I'm invested in those kids in my time and effort to make sure that they know. And that's something I tell them all the time. Like, it takes me 2 hours to get there each way. Like, I spend as much time driving here and going home as I do here. So I go, I'm spending time with y'all because I think you have something of value worth saying and writing and, you know, and it's exposing them to as much as I can. So I try to bring stories up there and talk and let them tell their
stories. Bring guest teachers.
I went. And you just sit there and you're like, fuck, like this is so necessary, but it needs so much more.
Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? One of my friends, a group in New York, they run, her name is Janice Johnson. She's a teacher at John Jay in New York. And she has a thing called Girls Camp. It's like a girls camp. It's just, and they have to apply to get into this camp. But to get into the camp, they interview the entire girls circle. So all the people that they interact with, so they kind of can see what they need to look out for when they're dealing with these girls. And they do stuff like no sugar for the first week and all these things. And I think those things are so important, not just for girls, but also for all the kids, for young people in general. Because, you know, I get them snacks, but I don't buy them any flaming hot shit. I don't do any of that stuff because I'm telling about the fucking their body. Like what you put in your body is just as important as what you're listening to.
Right.
So when we just dissect the fucking music they listen to, I'm like, this is what you listen to every day. And this, at some point, manifests itself in some other fucking way.
Yeah,
and so you need to understand
it penetrates.
What you do, what you put in your system, what you put in your head, at some point comes to a clash, and we got to work on that. So,
what do you think is the, I talk a lot all the time about transferable skills, how people don't really realize that the things they might learn on the street or the things they might learn at home, these skills are so transferable into when it comes to business, when it comes to anything. So what is your opinion on what are the transferable skills that poetry teaches you that they can later on use in life?
I thought you meant like the shit they're doing and how they can apply it in other worlds.
Oh, well,
we can get
there too. But I mean, I'm specifically talking about the program that you've cultivated there. Like, what have you seen any
Understanding
results?
Language. Yeah. I think language is important. The mastery of your language and understanding that talking in front of your friends is different than talking in front of your judge and the PO. And you go, hey, so this nigga said da-da-da. That's not working in front of the judge. So you have to understand. Not being white or anything, it's understanding who you're talking to.
Yeah.
Hopefully you don't talk to your parents like in a fucked up way. So understanding who you talk to. And so I talk to them like that. And I also make a lot of eye contact with them. I want them to know everything I'm saying is for them. I'm delivering it to them specifically so they know what's up. And I go, when you talk to people, it should be that. When you give a handshake, I should feel something. It shouldn't be some shit like spaghetti in my fingers. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I think I notice that. And I notice how they cut down on certain crutch words. You know, I don't want them like and because kids constantly, you know, like I was like doing this thing and like, you know, da da da, and like she was crazy. And then the other is
like you didn't
female.
Say anything. You said a lot of
you said a lot of like. And then the other is like females. I hate that they can't say that. So anytime they're like, yes, I was messing with this female, I'm like, you're a rabbit. They're like, no, I'm like this female. I'm like, horses. Like a female. I'm like,
a female what? Yeah, a female human is a
kangaroo?
Woman.
A kangaroo? And they're like, a woman? And I'm like, was that hard?
Because
it wasn't hard.
Precision of language.
Precision of language, but it also dehumanizes what the things are. And so it's like, because the first time it was even mentioned was in the context of, I was fucking on this female. And I'm like, fucking on a female? So it's not even, it's not even like a fucking person. So you were just fucking something. And he's like, yeah, you know. I'm like, no, I don't. We have to talk. So let's start talking.
Mm-hmm.
And getting them to feel comfortable telling their story, the other thing. So after a while, them getting up there and not feeling weird saying, whether it's just some random shit or just something that has happened in their lives. And so, and how
not that being
has affected
afraid of
them.
Their own voice, because that's what poetry has taught me.
Yeah.
Because so, you will have to ask yourself how you actually feel and then have the courage to say it out loud. And that's pretty you know, that's like hard.
Yeah.
And so especially when you are in a school like an alternative school like Phoenix, right? Like there, I've taught at so many different schools like that. But I think that the overarching lesson that I've got is how brilliant they are, mm-hmm. but also how difficult it is to get to that brilliance because of all the shit that's put on top of it.
Yeah.
And so it's like other people might have access to resources and this and that. And yeah, of course they get book deals and of course they get this because they don't have to deal with poverty, which is a whole boulder on top of
That's a whole nother, that's the fucking walking through fucking Whole Foods. I'm sitting there like, yo, when you go to fucking, and I tell this to the kids because, you know, Santa Clarita is where they go sell the chocolates because that's where the money,
they
go to Santa Clarita and they sell the chocolates there. Mm-hmm. And I go, yeah, you know, like when you go to those areas, you notice the difference in how those people walk around. Mm-hmm. I said, they don't look angry. Motherfuckers, you walk through Whole Foods, motherfuckers like, I'm taking my time.
Yes.
This $6 quarter and my, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. You're like, fuck. Or, and even if you take it beyond just something like that, it's getting 45 seconds to cross the street here and being on Crenshaw's Lawson is 15 seconds.
Right.
That adds fucking stress. Those are things that create problems. And that's I think real. When I talk to the kids, I'm like, that's stuff you be aware of. So one of the exercises we do in the class is we change something every week in the class. And we don't say what it is. It could be something small. It could be that little plaque right there is just turned around. But the thing is, they come in class and, okay, you got 5 minutes to figure out what's changed. And why is that important? Because this is the environment you're in every fucking day. And you should notice when things start to change.
That's real.
So when you're in areas and you're home, you start noticing when shit's different. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember visiting Thea one time down in Leimert. And I remember seeing like a white family on a fucking bike with a little thing pulling the kid. I was like, oh, shit, it's about to go down.
Yeah.
And y'all think it's just some woman like moving in
it's
here. Like
right now.
If she fucking is running around here, it's coming.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think those things I talk to the kids about, being aware of their surroundings and knowing what's up.
Yeah.
Because I go, you notice in your neighborhood when someone ain't supposed to be there, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, then you should fucking notice more than just that.
Yeah.
You know, notice everything in your areas. When certain stores start to open and certain fucking, you're like, oh, really? You got soy milk? Oh, shit. You know, there was a poet named Danny Hawk, and he had a show, and he talked about when he was growing up that the bodega at the corner of his... by his house, that he had asked the owner to buy soy milk for his sister because his sister had issues and she couldn't drink regular milk. And he's no. And then the white people started moving in and all of a sudden he got all the multiple fucking brands of soy
almond,
milk. And it's like,
oat.
That's fucked up. But you start noticing that. And sometimes you notice while someone's saying it, you should take it upon yourself to be aware enough to go, oh,
Yeah.
Okay. You know?
Mm-hmm. So I'm so glad that you're there to just kind of like, because you're kind of like the common sense guy. Like you like add that into every situation. And that's something that I always appreciate about you is like, you can always find Shihan to be a voice of reason in terms of like, just like you said, noticing what's going on and actually like paying attention to shit that's fucked up and like how shit actually is, as opposed to coming from a place that's always like highly emotional and like I tend to be. But yeah, so I want to thank you both so much for being here.
No,
and
you.
I just, I know that this was a long ass conversation,
no,
but
it's good though.
I'm so happy that this is the way we started, that this is the way I started my, like, you know, being in the studio journey, was because it's two people that I feel are just important to the community, but also, especially you, just been important in my growth as a person.
Thank you.
And so I want to say thank you for that. I have a last question for you.
All right.
Did you watch Don't Fuck With Cats?
I did watch Don't Fuck With Cats. What's crazy is the guy, I had seen that video of what he did to the dude before I saw this whole documentary.
One guy to ice picks.
I saw that video
whatever.
Years ago.
Oh my God.
So when I saw it in the thing, I'm like, oh shit.
Yeah.
I remember I showed that to somebody and they were like, oh my God, what the fuck are you watching? You know, like, exactly. Because this shit you see and you can't turn away. You're like, why am I looking at them die? Like, it's fucked up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you're drawn
you almost
to the
can't believe that it's real.
Yo, it is bananas.
Like, so the whole like, Netflix, like,
I have an issue with
formula.
That movie.
Formula has been lately, just when you think shit is crazy.
Yes.
Plot twist, it gets crazier.
Yes.
So,
but the fucked up thing in that to me, separate from obviously him killing those people and killing the animals, I thought it was really fucked up that white people in the fucking documentary would go exactly like this. They'd go, and he killed that guy and he stabbed him with the thing. Then he grabbed the dog. And I'm like, wait a second. The dog gets the fucking...
It was a cat.
No, but yeah. Remember the second one, the guy, it was he pulled the puppy out and killed the fucking puppy. And I'm like, wait, so for the puppy, you get the fucking, oh my God.
Yeah.
But the Asian dude that got killed is like, he stabbed him up.
Yeah.
But then he grabbed the puppy. And you're like, motherfucker.
Yeah.
I don't care now. I'm mad that you fucking cried over the fucking puppy, but the dude who got killed is just like, we got it.
Yeah. That whole movie is just
killing me.
It's so much. And I was like, I'm so glad
and the
to hear
time it. And the time that they spent on that shit, I'm like, you know what? You could have followed Zimmerman around.
Ooh,
you could have followed.
That's something I'm ready to
you
watch.
You know what I'm saying? There's so much shit. Like watching that, I'm like, the things, and it's fucked up saying it's white people, but I'm like, because that's who's in the fucking doc. You're like, you find time to find a motherfucker who killed some fucking cats, but all the shit going on
ooh,
with
George
all the
Zimmerman
regular fucking people,
other.
it's like, that just happens. Mm-hmm. But, you know, because you're like, oh man, this is, it's fucked up. So when I'm watching it, obviously it's crazy watching and I'm like, it's entertaining, yeah. But at the mm-hmm. same time, I'm like, these motherfuckers, if they spent this much time, they were doing, like, they're like, and that the vacuum cleaner comes from, they only sell that in Southern
in North
Canada.
America,
you're like,
yeah.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
What the fuck?
They can solve, the Facebook group can solve any crime, but George yeah. Zimmerman's walking around a free man.
Yeah.
Huh? That's the tea.
Bullshit.
So, again, I thank you so much for being on the Millennial Mija podcast.
Of course.
Thank you for having
me. You're welcome. I appreciate y'all, and yeah, we're going to wrap it up. So when did you start your tightrope walking career?
It was, I don't know, about 12 years ago. 12 years ago, it was good.
Yeah.
Hello?
It's the motherfucking Millennial Mija podcast.